Pseudopod, episode 131, February 27th, 2009. This week's story, The Corpse Army of Khartoum, by Grady Hendrix. This week's Pseudopod is brought to you by Audible. With a library of over 40,000 titles, Audible are offering you a free audiobook download to try them out. So, go to www.audiblepodcast.com/pseudopod and claim your free book now. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair Stewart, and it gives me the utmost pleasure to welcome back the intrepid two-fisted chronicler of the White Street Society, Mr. Grady Hendrix. Mr. Hendrix enjoyed a tremendous amount of success with his last tale of the society, The Hairy Ghost, and so, without further ado, I will get out of the way and let him tell you the story of the Corpse Army of Khartoum. Your narrator's moral character is, it must be said, dubious, but Mr. Hendrix's story, that is true. Tales of the White Street Society, The Corpse Army of Khartoum, by Grady Hendrix. It had been some time since we had last been called to a meeting of the White Street Society, and all of us yearned to quench the thirst for the strange that those meetings had fostered in our souls. That is why the three of us, Drake, Lewis, and myself, finally abandoned formality and stopped by the clubhouse uninvited, fully expecting Augustus to be absent, overseas perhaps, investigating some mysterious mystery. Instead, we stood, frozen, in surprise, and dripping with February rain, in the doorway of the clubroom, watching our old friend sitting by the fire and reading the papers, as cool as an oyster. "Augustus!" cried Drake. "What are you doing here?" "Where's Charles?" said Lewis, as an unfamiliar manservant helped him off with his overcoat. "Good evening," Augustus Mortimer said. "Brandy?" "I say, Mortimer," Drake chided, "that's an awfully cool reception. We have heard neither hide nor hair from you for months, so we come dashing over here, expecting the worst, and instead find you surrounded by unfamiliar servants, acting as if nothing is amiss. If you let Charles go, then there had better be an explanation." "Calm yourself, Drake," Augustus said. "Charles is still in my employ, but he attends to other duties now. Why don't you sit and have a brandy? According to the papers, the weather outside is positively foul." Soaking wet, we sat, and this new valet poured us each a brandy as Augustus turned his attention back to the newspapers, occasionally circling an item that caught his interest. For some time, there was no sound save the ticking of the clock and the occasional pop from the hearth. "So," Lewis said. "So," I said. "Hmm?" Augustus said, conclusively ending the matter. The silence dragged on. Finally, Drake could stand it no longer, and he leapt to his feet. "Now look here, Augustus," he said. "Your brandy is finer than usual, and the quality of your cigars has greatly improved since our last visit, and I admit that your new man seems adequate, but I came for conversation, and if you have none to offer, then I shall go out and pay for it." "I forget that the silence seems inhospitable," Augustus said, "for I have been in Egypt, and there the clamour is quite overwhelming." "Egypt?" Drake said, sitting back down. "That's more like it. How did you find it?" "Egyptian," Augustus said. "Egypt." Lewis breathed, his eyes shining. "What wonders did you encounter in that land of mystery and antiquity?" "Not one," Augustus said. "The food is oily, as are the people. Cairo is like a second-rate Philadelphia, only more crowded, and outside of the city, the country contains not a single site of any interest." "The Great Pyramids of Giza?" Lewis asked. "Derelict wrecks." "The Sphinx?" "Covered in guano and with grotesque proportions. A child could sculpt better." "What about the Nile?" "An open sewer." "No, Egypt was entirely devoid of interest," Augustus said. Then he called his man over, handed him the folded newspaper, and gave him whispered instructions. The man slipped from the room on padded feet. "Then if you're finished dashing young Lewis's dreams," Drake declared, "I am going to find more interesting company." "As you wish, Drake," Augustus said, "but you haven't yet asked me about the Sudan."
"You went to the Sudan?" Lewis asked.
"Was it dreary and awful too?"
"On the contrary," Augustus said, "for it was in the Sudan that I encountered a gruesome adventure that has changed my life for ever."
Drake sat back down.
"Caught your interest, have I?" Augustus asked. "Well, stoke the fire and pass around the cigars. While we wait for the rain to pass, I shall tell you of the Corpse Army of Khartoum."
"Cairo is a filthy place," Augustus began, "a wealthy and decadent puppet state with the hand of Lord Salisbury shoved up its backside. The British have blackmailed Khedive Tawfiq to keep the Suez Canal open for their goods, forcing this dusky devil to sing God Save the Queen in order to keep pounds sterling clinking into his coffers. The Suez Company owns and operates Egypt in its entirety, with a blessing from Queen Victoria herself. My older sister, who was something of an adventurer in her early years, had the misfortune to marry a Scotsman enrolled in service to the Queen, and this ruddy-cheeked blowhard relocated their household, ill-advisedly, to Cairo. Before my sister could complain, he had filled her to overflowing with babies. I had been thinking of visiting them in order to discuss some family matters.
"You needed to borrow money," Drake cried. "Well, not just that," Augusta said.
"You could have asked me for a loan," Lewis chimed in. "No need to go all the way to Cairo."
"The main purpose of my journey was to visit my sister's children," Augusta snapped.
"How many does she have?" Drake asked.
"Some,"
Augustus replied. "How many is some?"
"Between 5 and 13,
Augustus replied. "The number of children is irrelevant." "Not to your sister," Lewis observed.
"I admit..."
There was more to my visit than conducting a census of my sister's brood. My brother-in-law is a financially cautious man, and his bank accounts sit and gather dust. I thought perhaps I could interest him in some investments, for my sister's sake. And so I travelled to Cairo. My sister was overjoyed at my arrival, and her many children felt similarly. My brother-in-law was in Luxor, and so business matters would have to wait until his return 3 days hence. It took one day to exhaust all that Cairo had to offer, and I spent the remaining two in a state of tedium that at times approached insanity. At sunset on the third day, I was at the Sheepherd Hotel, medicating myself with a whiskey and soda. On the hotel porch, hawkers stage fights between trained babies and baboons, and I had just lost a considerable sum when my brother-in-law materialized. Imagine, if you will, a sunburned hippopotamus sporting a great white beard and wearing a kilt, and you have him, a man whose idiocy approaches the genius.
"Douglas," I cried, grasping his hand.
"Shinorli,"
he moaned in his incomprehensible brogue.
"Graustar and Borge."
So I ordered him a whiskey and soda. After drinking two more, he reverted to something approaching the King's English.
"You're a cheeky divil," he muttered, "coming here to touch me for a loan."
"Now look here," I warned him. "I'm merely volunteering to guide you in some investments of which I've recently become aware. All your money will return to you, minus a small fee for handling the matter. You'll find it's quite in line with what any bank would charge you."
"You're not any bank, are you?"
he mumbled, while having the gall to order yet another whiskey and soda.
"You're me good gal's reprobate brother who can't hold a job to save his life, and who spends all his time mucking about with spiritualism."
My astonishment that he knew a long word like reprobate almost kept me from becoming offended that he had characterized my scientific work as if it were the mere twaddlings of some seance Cindy going to hear the ramblings of dear dead Uncle Cedric on a rainy Sunday afternoon.
"You think you come over here to pinch some of me cash? Then think again, boyo. I'm scant. Haven't had the nerve to tell your sister, but I couldn't even pay for these whiskies. Until my next paycheck, I don't have nothing in my pocket worth spending, so beg all you like. You'll get naught."
And with that, this vile relation heaved himself upright and stumbled off into the dusty Sunset City. I sat in a stupor for a moment, feeling that all was lost. It is a terrible thing to need money when you're halfway around the world in a filthy foreign city like Cairo. I had bought a one-way ticket, you see, trusting in the investment opportunities I was offering my brother-in-law to see me home. I was on the verge of despair, so, perhaps, that explains why I screamed when I felt a touch upon my arm.
"My apologies, sir," said a dapper fellow. "I heard a bit of that conversation with Red Harry, and I wanted to let you know that we've taken up a collection in your honour and would like to use it to buy you a drink."
It was the first decent thing I'd heard in days, and so I joined the party of this silky, well-dressed gentleman and his glittering young friends.
They were like visitors from another world. How on earth did they keep themselves so clean? In Cairo. After a few hours' conversation, I understood that they had come to Egypt to make their fortunes, but once here, they had had no idea what to do next. They were young. They were idealistic. They were full of God and empire, and eventually I found myself so intoxicated with their company that I went to the bar to buy another round with money I did not have. "Excuse me," I said to a grizzled, sunburnt man with no arms or legs perched on a stool and lapping whiskey from a saucer. He began to weep. "There, there," I said to the sobbing stump. "It's not that bad." I wanted the bartender to hurry over so I could distance myself from this mockery of a man, making a disgraceful spectacle of himself, who leant against my side and sobbed.
"It is that bad, sir," he said. "I served with Chinese Gordon and I lost everything in Khartoum. My mates, my fortune, my arms and my legs. They'll grow back," I said. "They will?" he asked through his tears.
"Of course they will. I'm a doctor. You just have to give them time. And drink more whiskey."
"I love Chinese Gordon," he moaned. "He was God's general. God's general right here on earth. But the woolies hate God, don't they?
Some people will never be happy. I had just told this grotesque fellow that his arms and legs would grow back, and he had the gall to whinge on about some romantic attachment to his military superior. Who was Chinese Gordon, of all people? I had generally a low opinion of Chinese Gordon at the time, the abolitionist British general sent to the Sudan to wipe human trafficking from the map. The British were never quite comfortable with their religious visionaries, and so when, against all human reason, Gordon's mad crusade seemed to be bearing fruit, they abandoned him in Khartoum while the Ansar laid siege for almost a year before taking the city and his head. The beheading of Chinese Gordon marked the expulsion of the white man from the Sudan, and the beginning of that land's long descent into a nightmare of unreason and superstition, ushered in by the Makhti and the Ansar, his fanatical Muslim army. But then, this alcoholic amputee began to tell me a very, very different story, and gradually, my impatience faded. I shan't bore you with the details, but suffice to say that when he finally stopped talking, I was convinced that not only had this man lost his limbs in a manner involving both iron hooks and crocodile fishing, and that not only were the Ansar cruel beyond all human understanding, but also that through some quirk of the paranormal, Chinese Gordon's decapitated head was still alive and supposedly possessed oracular powers. Perhaps then, my trip to Egypt was not a waste after all. What a discovery. The living head of the world's most notorious abolitionist, able to peer into the future. It was, I'm sure you'll agree, a must-have item. But how to equip an expedition 500 miles up the Nile to Khartoum? How to fight the thousands of Allah-mad Ansar who would butcher us as soon as we landed? How to make my way into the heart of these Muslim fortifications and steal this mystical relic without losing any of my limbs? At that moment I heard "O Send Them to Golgotha," that week's chosen song of the abolitionist movement, rising up like some repellent dirge in the lounge. I winced in embarrassment as I realised it came from the young gentleman I had recently befriended, but my shame turned to elation as I looked at their expensive clothes, listened to their abolitionist moanings, and saw their irrepressible high spirits. I ordered pink gins all around and explained to them my unique proposition. 1 week later, we were on a steamer headed up the Nile, already past the first cataract and making good time to Mektemeh. Young Harry, Winston, Standish, Lyle and Merrimack, my young, optimistic abolitionist friends, had hired a company of riflemen, and now they were only too delighted to be going to liberate the slaves of the Sudan and recover the remains of their movement's saint. Our journey took 2 weeks, giving me ample time to become acquainted with our mercenaries. They were Egyptian soldiers who had deserted the British army, and most of them were slave owners. But they had no problem carrying arms for my abolitionist friends, because the money was good, and they were sure the mission would fail long before it reached Khartoum. However, their suspicions that we were all soft-headed made conversation difficult. Fortunately, I discovered that one of them, Abdul al-Maziri, was a hashish addict, and on the third day I confiscated his stash of that tarry drug. The skull-pounding summertime heat was enough to drive any man mad, but Abdul in particular found himself crawling out of his skin without his narcotic. It was simplicity itself to dole out to him a small amount of his necessary for news of Khartoum, and that was how I learned the lay of the land. Khartoum was a ghost city. The Ansar had raped and plundered it into submission, and then into ruin. When disease rose up like a wildfire from the piles of rotten corpses in the streets, they abandoned the city and repaired to their sprawling military camp of Omdurman across the Nile. Omdurman, the tent city, had put down foundations and slathered itself in stucco and brick, had grown walls and streets, markets and minarets, piling layer upon layer upon layer on itself like an oyster's shell. And the pearl in the middle of this oyster was the Khalifa, ruler of the Ansar army, a most dangerous man, my friends, paranoid and mad, a massive, bloated drunkard poised to expand the Muslim empire across Egypt and into Africa. As we approached Omdurman, it became clear that we needed a plan, so as not to be slaughtered the second we put down our gangplank. I had no doubt that the forces of the Khalifa were totally insane. At night, while dining with my abolitionist friends, this issue was turned over and over, prodded and probed and discussed from various angles, yet we never arrived at a general solution. Meanwhile, the servants and mercenaries became more and more nervous as we made our way up the Nile, past the first, the second, the third cataracts, then past the joining of the Atbara River and down towards Khartoum, where the mighty Nile split into the white and the blue. Each landmark was one more tick on the clock, counting down to our doom. Each morning brought news of more deserters. And then came the day, just before tea time, with the sixth cataract thundering off our stern, when the ruined towers of Khartoum hove into view. Omdurman was clearly visible on the other side of the Nile, a low blot on the horizon, smudged with the smoke of 1,000 dung fires. It was with a sinking feeling that I realized our plan of attack consisted entirely of standing on the gangplank, singing hymns and holding 3 white baby lambs as a gesture of peace, then asking the Khalifa politely for General Gordon's head to be returned. From a strategic point of view, there were flaws, but I decided to keep my doubts to myself and be off the rear of the ship while the Ansar's attention was focused on the front. "You convinced those abolitionists to join you on your journey and left them to die?" Drake said in disbelief. "Not to die, no," Augustus said, "merely to serve as a distraction, as it happens." "They did die, quite horribly, in fact, but that was through no fault of mine." The Ansar had kept the docks at Khartoum in use, and they massed on them in the hundreds from the moment our steamer first hove into view. By the time we were ready to let down the gangplank, there were hundreds of them waiting in an eerie silence. My abolitionist friends were nervous, but determined that God was with them, so I left them to it, and, as the low, moaning sound of "O send me to Golgotha" rose into the baking summer air, I slipped off the stern into the Nile and hid beneath the rear of the ship until sunset, while the Ansar rounded up our remaining mercenaries, servants, ship's crew, the abolitionists, and clapped them in chains. The lambs were promptly roasted and eaten. Night fell, and under cover of darkness, I swam for Omdurman and snuck into a mosque that was left unlocked. I hid in a side room at the top of the minaret and slept until I was awakened by the muezzin calling for prayers at dawn's first light. The city was abuzz, like a giant anthill stirred with a stick, and, fortunately, from high up in the minaret I could see the centre of the excitement quite clearly. It was an open square on which stood a gallows. I was amazed to discover an instrument of civilization so deep within this savage country, but I became slightly depressed when I realized that my friends were lined up next to it. After a list of their crimes were read in Arabic, they began to hang them by the neck until dead. There were 50 of them, altogether, and after the first 10 or 11 were hung, the ropes began to break. Swords and axes were summoned, and the prisoners were beheaded for a little while, but the process moved slowly, and the swords had to be sharpened frequently. Heads were tossed into the crowd like coconuts, while the town butchers were summoned in order to chop off the hands and feet of the remaining mercenaries. This they did, and the discarded members formed great bloody piles that starving children stole and grilled and sold as snacks. When the executioners reached my friends in the late afternoon, they were exhausted, and so they kicked them off to the gallows and into the crowd, who, it is my sad duty to report, tore them limb from limb while they screamed, and begged for mercy. It was at this point that I began to re-evaluate my position. Here I was, in a minaret, in a mosque, in the most radically anti-Western city on the planet, surrounded by 500 miles of desert in every direction. At my feet lay 45,000 people who hated the white man as an article of faith, and I was the only white man within reach. Plus, I didn't speak a word of the local language, and my shirt was terribly dirty. It would take a cockeyed optimist to see that my situation did not look bleak. In my depression, I forgot that these desert devils prayed to their monstrous god 5 times a day, and as a result I was more than a little startled when the door opened and the elderly muezzin walked in. The old fellow radiated a rustic nobility from his strong-featured face and well-shaped head. He was old, but his white beard was lustrous, and his limbs possessed a rude vigour. I could tell that he was as surprised to find me in his minaret as I was to be found, and we both gawked at each other for a moment before he opened his mouth to raise the alarm, and I punched him in the face. Staggering about the room, hands pressed to his nose, which was gushing blood, he howled in pain. I had been merely trying to distract him and flee, and so no one was more surprised than I when he staggered to the edge of the minaret, tripped against the railings, and fell to his death. A minute later, I was surrounded by the Khalifa's guard, 12 rifles pressed to my skull. "Did they kill you?" shouted Drake, unable to contain himself. "Obviously not, Drake," Augusta said. "Instead, they put me in chains and took me to the palace of the Khalifa Abdullahi." I had heard tell of these foreign despots and their gleaming pleasure palaces, and I hope one day to be imprisoned and tortured in one of them, but for now, I must make do with the Khalifa's palace at Omdurman, which is, frankly, underwhelming. It was the only 2-story building in the city, with the stinking slave market pressed in on one side and the filthy prison leaning in on the other. I was passed from guard to guard until finally I reached one clean enough to drag me into the presence of the Khalifa himself. They pushed me to the dirt floor, pressed my forehead to the ground, and left me there while they gabbled in their tongue. Sweat trickled into my eyes, and it was all getting a bit much, when I heard a voice speaking German-accented English. "You are a British subject?" I looked up and saw before me that traitor to Christianity, Rudolf Karl von Slatin, the Austrian Governor-General of Darfur, who had surrendered to the Mahdi, converted to Islam, and wore the most ridiculous moustache in all of Christendom. "I am an American," I said. "My name is Augustus Mortimer, and I demand to be returned to Cairo at once. So coming, so going, these are not simple things. Here the Khalifa governs and makes these decisions for us," he said. Von Slatin conferred with the Khalifa in their sneaky language, and I took this moment to steal a glance at the Sudan's mad ruler. He was a molten mountain of lard. His features vanished beneath a slow avalanche of fat, his fingers and toes buried beneath rolls of jaundiced flesh. He was immense, clad in silks and brocade, and he moved with the speed of an intoxicated sloth. Before I could register more, a guard concluded my observations with a foot to my face. "It is forbidden for the likes of you to gaze upon the wondrous Khalifa," von Slatin said by way of explanation. "Come!" As an alarming buzz darted about the room, a clutch of armed natives led by von Slatin dragged me outside. "Where are you taking me?" I demanded. "You are so lucky," von Slatin hissed. "You are to be imprisoned and lightly tortured before your execution." "Why is being lightly tortured considered lucky?" "Because the man you pushed out of the window was the last honourable man in Omdurman, and so no one has the time to torture you heavily. For you, the death will be fast, and you will greet it having all your teeth and fingernails." "Wait," I cried. "No, there is a schedule," von Slatin said. "The sun is going down." It was as if the alarming buzz had trailed us out of the palace, and now it raced through the city like wildfire. Crowds were gathering, clotting on the corners and jabbering in their heathen tongue. Fear swept the mud hovels and hell shacks of Omdurman as the citizenry emptied onto the streets. Their eyes were focused southwest, in the direction of the setting sun. "Wait," I called to von Slatin. "I am the foremost American authority on spiritualism. I have come all this way to see the oracular head of General Gordon, and if it truly exists, please, let me gaze upon it once before I die." "The head just talks some nonsense," this prancing Prussian priest said. "I can decipher it," I said. "I understand the language of the head." Von Slatin paused, genuinely torn, and then he barked orders to the guard in Arabic and we changed direction. "We go now to my quarters," he said. "You are lucky I am taking you places. You will tell me what the head is saying."
For a prisoner of the Khalifa, von Slatin did enjoy certain privileges. He could walk around the city unshackled. He had his own quarters, his own allowance. In return, he translated and advised the Khalifa, always reading his moods as if they were the weather, and he, a sailor adrift on an ocean of the Khalifa's winds. Omdurman was his prison, though, as surely as it was mine. His guards posted themselves outside his quarters, and he sneered at me through his silly moustache. "How did you hear as a head of General Gordon?" he asked. "I'll answer you if you answer me," I said, pressing my advantage. "What is everyone so worked up about? No, nothings, your rash actions have merely doomed us all." "I find that hard to believe. I have impeccable manners." "Sir Muezzin, you defenestrated, was the last faithful Muslim in Omdurman. As long as he calls the prayers, the dead stay in the ground and allows the Khalifa and his followers to engage in the decadence. The corpses of those who died taking Khartoum are hungry. To bring Sharia to the living and their law is a harsh judgment. Savers root out all traces of Christian corruption. The rifles, the liquors, the hoarding of wealth and tobacco, the fornicators, all would die at the hands of the Ansar dead. It would be most unpleasant. Only the voice of Ismail stood between these sinners and our total destruction, and now he is dead." "I'm sorry," I said. "Fairy tales always bore me, and I must have nodded off. Now I believe you have a head to show me." Snarling, von Slatin pulled out an oiled sandalwood box, and from within it he produced a silken sack. The smell of uncured leather shot fire through my nostrils as he pulled out the severed head of Chinese Gordon. It had been washed, barbered, perfumed, but underneath the rose water I could still smell its death stink. The general's eyes were rolled back in their sockets, but from his beard a mumbling came forth. It was merely a nerve reaction, and a not very interesting one at that, and I was depressed I had come all this way for nothing. And then, "The hands are piled in a mountain," he cried in a strong, clear voice. "A mountain range of black hands. The Rubber River flows north. Imsiri whispers of Casement and Morel." "Stop it!" hissed von Slatin. "You're going to die, Carl," General Gordon's head said to von Slatin. "You're going to die! They shall stalk the streets, and they shall rub out every vestige of Christendom." "I think," I said. The sound of panic in the streets filtered in through the wooden shutters, and he began to laugh. "The black tide will drown you all! You're all going to die!" Von Slatin turned quite pale and called to his guards, who came into the room trembling and whimpering. Von Slatin dashed out the door and up the stairs and to the roof, while I followed as best I could. Behind me I could hear General Gordon start in on the first verse of "O Send Them to Golgotha." The sun sat on the western horizon like an ugly red eye. Von Slatin pointed out over the White Nile towards Kalakala, near the ruined walls of old Khartoum. "They're coming," he breathed. "The corpse army of Khartoum." At first I saw only a cloud of dust rising from the desert sand, but soon I could make out ragged brown skeletons, clad in scraps of dried meat, staggering out of the dust cloud, and when the wind brought me their scent, it was of dried chicken, spiced with cinnamon. A Harmattan wind began to blow, and as it passed through their taut, exposed sinews, it produced a dreadful sound, like the violins of hell howling and screeching. And then these things turned their grizzled heads on Omdurman, and they began to walk. Screams rose up from the city below, and, like metal filings drawn by a magnet, the population streamed eastwards, away from the advancing corpse army. From where we were standing, we could see the dead Ansar emerge out of the dust cloud and fall upon late-returning fishermen, drunk on local sorghum wine, and tear them limb from limb whilst they were still alive. Their cries floated faintly to us in the summer dusk. I knew in an instant what I must do. "Von Slatin," I said, "unlock these manacles. We must defend the city gates." He looked at me for a moment, confused. "Come on, man! There's no time to lose. You'll need every able-bodied man you can find. I can use a rifle, and I have no intention of being murdered by a horde of dead Muslimmen." My logic appealed to von Slatin's Prussian mind, and he unlocked my chains, whereupon I promptly pushed him off the roof. "Don't look so shocked, Lewis. It was only a one-story fall, and I'm sure the crowd just trampled him." Most of them were barefoot anyway. However, I didn't take the time to peer over the edge and ascertain his well-being. Instead, I dashed to his quarters and seized the silk bag containing Chinese Gordon's head and ran from the building, pausing only to disguise myself in one of von Slatin's white silk jibbers. From the roof, I had seen that the city gates were not far to my east, and that is where I headed. I was pushing against a tide of terrified natives, but they paid no mind to the mad white man dashing straight into the jaws of death. The eerie orchestra of the corpse army's stretched sinews was getting louder than the screams around me, and I felt as if I were racing into the centre of a maelstrom. I arrived at the city walls, where barked orders drew my attention to the parapets, where the remainder of the Ansar army was being bullied into making one last stand. Their captain screamed abuse as his soldiers, knees knocking, gripped their sweaty rifles and hoped to live to see the dawn. I raced up the stairs to the top of the wall, and what I saw filled me with hope and terror in equal measure. Terror because what I saw was beyond all sane understanding. The Ansar had fallen by the thousands during their year-long siege of Khartoum, and their bodies had been baked by the sun and stripped of flesh by the scouring sands. Now, animated by their hunger to eradicate heresy, they had heaved themselves up from the grave, jaws hanging agape, blind eye sockets filled with sand, lungs hanging in tatters, and they marched on Omdurman determined to wipe out the defiled city, a zombie jihad armed with weaponized faith. And there were thousands of them, enough to ungut every man, woman, and child in the city. A few scattered rifles barked up and down the wall as jittery Ansar pulled their triggers in terror, but mostly they held firm, waiting for their dead comrades to draw closer, and that was when I felt hope rising in my breast. Just then, the head of Chinese Gordon began to bray Jerusalem in an obnoxious baritone. "And did those feet in ancient time," he bellowed, "walk upon England's mountains green?" Curious heads turned towards me as I stuffed a corner of my jibber into his mouth, and the cursed thing tried to bite me. "And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen?" "Shut up," I said. "And was Jerusalem builded here among these dark satanic mills?" The head and I were drawing undue attention, and so I abandoned the parapets before my reconnaissance was complete. But no matter. The sound of terrified horses led me quickly to a stable, while that jackass head continued to sing. If I had not come all that way to secure the damn thing, I would have pitched it into the crush of the walking dead outside the city gates, right then and there. I found the horses rolling their eyes, their muzzles flecked with foam and terror. A stable hand tried to chase me away, but I cracked him one in the skull with Gordon's head, and he went down like a stone. Needless to say, Gordon did not miss a note. "Bring me my bow of burning gold. Bring me my arrows of desire. Bring me my spear, O clouds unfurl. Bring me my chariot of fire." Mounting quickly, I galloped back to the wall where the firing had begun in earnest. The living Ansar on the walls had realized by now what I had realized earlier, that as long as they stood out of reach firing down on the corpse army, they would survive the night. The dead had rejected the pollution of Western ideas like ladders and siege machinery, and so they could merely press against the walls harmlessly, while the Khalifa's army tore them apart with their bullets. Things might not turn out so badly as long as this situation was maintained. Which is when I opened the city gates and galloped out into the corpse army of Khartoum. "My God," Drake said softly. "Were you mad?" "Not mad," said Augustus, "but I find torture disagreeable, and I was certain that if I remained in this city, the army would soon dispense of the corpses, and then von Slatin and the Khalifa would turn their attention back to me. I had only one chance, and I was taking it. And so, this Chinese Gordon's head, tied to my belt, started in on a mighty fortress is our God, with the Khalifa's army above me, and the living dead before me, I charged into their midst. Immediately there were blood-curdling screams as the fanatical corpses poured into the city, and no one had time to focus on one lone madman riding out into the face of certain death.
I could hear the firing line falling apart behind me as I rode, and I rode hard. The horse sensed what was around him as these things grabbed at his bridle, but he and I were fused into one being with a single purpose. Forward! And the animal acquitted itself nobly. Gordon's head didn't help in the slightest. It merely sang on. And though this world with devils filled should threaten to undo us, we will not fear, for God hath willed his truth to triumph through us. The dead broke into pieces before the horse's hooves as I beat the demons off with my bare hands, and we parted this mass of rotten tissue like the Red Sea. Behind us, their brown and dusty death march drained into Omdurman, but ahead of us, their rear came into sight, and finally, we broke through their line and galloped into the open desert like hell itself was behind us. Judging from the chorus of screams rising up from Omdurman, that was not so far wrong. "And then what?" asked Lewis in an awed whisper. I rode for 3 days before a steamer passed and I was able to secure passage back to Cairo. It was not a simple matter, but it was tedious the first time around, and I shan't bore myself by describing the journey again. I will say, however, that Gordon's head didn't shut up once the entire time. At night I was forced to bury it in the sand so that I could sleep. "It's an amazing tale," I said, finally speaking. "But come now, Augustus. Even for you this is too much. If such an adventure occurred, then, for example, where is the head of Gordon now? Shouldn't we all be hearing the strains of Meet Me in Golgotha?" "Oh no, my friend," Augustus said. "I have distracted him with other subjects. Come, I'll show you." "Augustus," I said as we rose to follow, "we are calling your bluff." Without a word, he led us upstairs and paused outside his study. "Listen now, you must not repeat word of this to anyone. I am trusting to both your discretion and to your honour." And with that, he opened the door onto a scene that is difficult to describe. One wall was hung with a large chart laying out company names matched with their stock market symbols, while on the desk a ticker tape machine chatted out the stock market movements. Charles attended to a small table in the centre of the room, but he wasn't cleaning because the floor was littered with paper. He turned upon seeing us and gave a slight bow. "Gentlemen," he said.
"Charles!" Drake exclaimed. "What are you doing hiding up here?"
"I am attending to General Gordon, sir," Charles said unflappably. And there, in the centre of the table, resting in a velvet-lined tray, was the head of General Gordon, his mouth moving and out of it coming an endless stream of numbers and letters, abbreviations and words I barely recognised.
"Is he speaking gibberish?" I asked Augustus. "Or is that Arabic?"
"Listen to him," Augustus said. "He's predicting tomorrow's stock market. American Mining Company up 5. Up 2 points, American Telegraph. Capital Steam Engine Consolidated down 1.5.
I was aghast.
"It has made me quite rich, if I may say so," said Augustus. As Lewis and Drake cooed over his system, the room swam before my eyes and I felt quite sick. I excused myself and ran downstairs where I leaned against the wall. I thought of the dead abolitionists, far from their home and their sweethearts, torn to shreds by a crowd of musclemen. I thought of the wives of their hired riflemen, eternally waiting for their husbands to come home. I thought of the city of Omdurman and its hundreds, murdered by the corpse army of Khartoum when Augustus had opened its gates. I thought of the vast road of blood that he had ridden in order to bring this thing back that made him money. So many dead so that he could enjoy a better brand of cigar, a finer brandy. It made me giddy. It made me sick. Money is different for men who are not born to it, and I knew that Augustus had not been born with money, but had had to scrape for it, and so he thought of it quite differently from the rest of us. It inspired within him a kind of madness, and every day there were born more and more like him. Men willing to lose their senses to secure a dollar. From upstairs I could hear Gordon's insane babbling, and the voices of Drake and Lewis and Augustus and Charles
and the clatter of the ticker tape machine, and in my mind I imagined it was the sound of Gordon's head spitting out blood-streaked gold coins, clinking one after the other into Augustus's vaults, and I thought of all the vaults around it in the bank, all of them smeared with gore, and I could smell it dripping and collecting, pooling on the marble floors and running together until it was a great stream, a cataract of blood, rushing down the steps of the banks and out into the city streets to drown us all. There is something incredibly brave about any author who is willing to take a hard left turn at the last possible moment. The final scenes of Blackadder Goes Forth were the first time I encountered it, and they still hit like a freight train even years later. Faced, finally, with going over the top, Blackadder pulls out all the stops in an attempt to get himself transferred off the front lines. It's classic, bitter, desperate comedy, with Rowan Atkinson's perpetually long-suffering, unlucky genius throwing everything he has left at the wall in an effort to save his life. He fails. The final scene is Blackadder, Baldric, Darling, and George, all of whom are clearly terrified, waiting for the whistle. It comes. They climb out of the trench. They die. Explosions consume the screen in slow motion, and the four men are lost in the smoke and debris, their final moments stretched to unbearable length as they are literally and metaphorically swallowed by the war. There's a moment of silence, the screen fades out, and then back up on a field of poppies, slowly shifting in the breeze. It's simple, pragmatic, and it breaks your heart every time you see it. There are similar moments everywhere. Some of my favourites, if that's the right word, include the point in The Prestige where you learn the one trick Borden can't escape, the moment you realise the only way Cloverfield can end, and the point in 30 Days of Night where an impossible act of heroism is prefaced by the simple piece of dialogue, "It's my turn." The final paragraphs of this story stand with all of them, and with the final moments of Blackadder Goes Forth. They all do the same thing. They all leave you, like Grady's narrator, out in the cold. It's one of the bravest things any author can do, and I have rarely seen it done better than Grady does it here. Moonlighting did not do this, although it must be said the Christmas special where David takes Maddie to one side after their Christmas Eve meeting with three NSA agents, all called King, and points out with glee that they're in the middle of an allegory is ace. It is, however, something myself and the man with the plan, Mr. Benjamin Phillips, have both been doing. If you can't get enough of our dulcet tones, then check out Transmissions from Beyond, where Ben read Pseudo-Tokyo, The Drabblecast, where Ben read All In, and I read Cork Ringtone and the Breakdancing Pig, and finally, Darker Projects, where I've wrangled a regular part as Casey, intrepid, frequently plot-explaining sidekick to the hero of Tales from the Museum, a horror action series which, as a long-term fan of The Relic, I get a massive kick out of being a part of. Ghost Radio by Leopoldo Gout, it will probably not surprise you, hit me, if not where I live, then certainly where I work. It's the story of Joaquin, his girlfriend and producer Alondra, and his engineer, Watts. Together, they put together Ghost Radio, a cult talk show which invites its listeners to call in with real ghost stories. They're very successful, so much so that a huge radio conglomerate offers to buy them out. Which is the exact point, that the walls between the real and the unreal collapse, and Joaquin is forced to confront his own fears to stop the airwaves being taken over by a very, very different kind of caller. Smart, funny, and about as close to a horror novel about podcasting as you're going to get, Ghost Radio is one of the 40,000 plus titles available from Audible now. Join and claim it as your free book, or if you fancy something else, it's not like they don't have plenty to choose from. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod would like to ask, suppose we do leave you alone, Mom? Do you suppose they will?